I've taken two texts, Psalm 76:10, "Surely the wrath of men shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain," and Hebrews 12:3, "For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds." Although Jesus went about doing nothing but good and preaching the gospel of the kingdom, the chief priests, elders, scribes, and Pharisees wanted to kill him. Jeremiah has said, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." These men truly had deceitful and desperately wicked hearts. To conspire to kill a depraved and sinful man is bad enough. Such an act might be rationalized by saying, after all, he deserves to die. But to conspire to kill one who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, who has perfect love, whose every waking hour is spent in doing good, that is an evil and culpable thing. Yet these evil men who held such high and honorable positions and wielded such great power in the Jewish nation, in spite of all their efforts, did not seem to succeed in their conspiracies against Jesus. When Jesus healed a man on the Sabbath, we read in Matthew 12:14, "Then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him, how they might destroy him. But nothing happened." On another occasion, as related in the 21st chapter of Matthew, Jesus told the chief priests and Pharisees the parable of the vineyard. He told them about the wicked husbandmen who killed the son and heir. They knew he spoke of them. He had read their murderous hearts. They were highly insulted. So we read, "And when the chief priests and Pharisees had heard this parable, they perceived that he spake of them. But when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitude. So again they could do nothing." Then there was the occasion when Jesus cleansed the temple, casting out them that sold and bought, overthrowing the tables of the money changers, and the seats of them that sold doves. And he told them bluntly that they had made his father's house a den of thieves. This statement was unpardonable in their eyes. He had not only interfered in a very profitable business arrangement of theirs, but he had also implied in public that they were thieves. This hurt their dignity. So what did they do? We read in Mark 11:18 that they sought how they might destroy him. But they didn't seem to be able to do it. Another time, a helpless cripple who had been in that condition for 38 years was made by Jesus to arise, take up his bed, and walk. The leaders of the Jews objected. Now, what was so bad about that? Why, it was done on the Sabbath. Never mind that a poor cripple had been gloriously healed. Their interpretation of the law had been violated. John 5:18 says, "Therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him, even more than before." But Jesus still lived. In Nazareth, they tried to throw him headlong over a cliff, but something went wrong, because Luke 4:30 says, "But he, passing through the midst of them, went his way." On another occasion, they sent a band of hired officers to take Jesus and bring him before the council to be condemned and killed. But the officers came back empty-handed, giving as the reason for their failure, "Never man spake like this man." Failure again. One day in the temple, the Jews bragged about Abraham being their father. And Jesus said, "Before Abraham was, I am." John 8:59 says, "Then they took up stones to cast at him." Ah, now there was some action. Not just scheming and counseling and planning in secret to kill Jesus. Now they had the stones in their hands, and Jesus stood before them. And they were furious. They were in the mood. But they must have suddenly got cinders in their eyes, because they never threw those stones. Jesus simply walked out of the temple. Then when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, they really got desperate. This was such a mighty display of power. "What shall we do?" they said. "If we let him alone, all men will believe on him." So we read in John 11:53, "Then from that day forth they took counsel together for to put him to death, but their counsel came to naught." Now why was it that they were always unsuccessful in their plans to kill Jesus? They were crafty men in high and powerful positions. They were willful men, used to having their own way. They were men calloused and utterly devoid of conscience. They saw all the good works of Jesus, all his healing miracles, and yet sought to kill him simply because he was in their way. They surely had the means to take him. They had their officers, their own private army or police force. Yet Jesus seemed to always slip from their grasp. Why? John 7:30 gives us the answer. This time Jesus had been teaching in the temple. Many accepted him as Messiah. Some said, "Do the rulers know indeed that this is the very Christ?" How little they knew what kind of men their rulers really were. And because they asked this question, their rulers were consumed with a jealous rage. We read, "Then they sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him, because his hour was not yet come." There we have the reason, and the same reason is given in John 8:20. This time Jesus had publicly rebuked the Pharisees for not acknowledging that he was from God. This made the Pharisees very angry, and they longed to kill him. But we read, "And no man laid hands on him, for his hour was not yet come." What is meant by this statement, "for his hour was not yet come"? I believe the meaning is twofold. Jesus had a specific work to do on earth. As he told Pilate when Pilate asked him if he was a king, "To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice." Jesus had come to offer himself as Israel's king, their Messiah. But as a nation, they rejected him. So he turned to individuals, to every one that is of the truth. As we read in John 1:11-12, "He came unto his own, and his own received him not. But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name." He opened up a new and living way. He established his church of Israelites indeed, spiritual Israel. He selected apostles and disciples who would carry on the work after he had left the earthly scene. And he glorified God on earth. So until he had finished this work, his hour was not yet come. And the other meaning is that he had to come to offer himself as a ransom sacrifice to be killed as the antitypical Passover lamb at a certain specific time and date in fulfillment of prophecy and not before. So no matter what the chief priests and elders and lawyers and scribes and Pharisees schemed, no matter how carefully they laid their plans, no matter what power they wielded, it came to nothing because his hour or time was not yet come. All the power of Almighty God protected him from harm until it was time. Jesus himself confirmed this in the most direct manner. He had just been betrayed with a kiss. This time he voluntarily surrendered himself to those whom the chief priests and scribes and elders had sent. In his zeal, one of his disciples sought to defend him with a sword. Jesus rebuked him, saying, as recorded in Matthew 26:53, "Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall give me more than 12 legions of angels?" Do you know how many angels that is? In those days, a Roman legion was 5,000. So 12 legions would be 60,000 angels. Not human soldiers with fleshly limitations subject to defeat, but powerful spirit beings with supernatural powers and irresistible strength. Do you fully realize the tremendous potential of even one angel? We read in Numbers 20 and 16 the words of Moses. And when we cried unto the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel, and hath brought us forth out of Egypt. And this is confirmed by Exodus 14:19. And the angel of God went before the camp of Israel. The might of Egypt was destroyed. One angel. Then there is the occasion related in 2 Samuel 24:15 and 16, when the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel by an angel of the Lord. And there died of the people from Dan even to Beersheba 70,000 men, one angel. Then we have the incident given in the 37th chapter of Isaiah, when Sennacherib the Assyrian sent a profane letter to Hezekiah, king of Judah, demanding surrender, insolently mocking them for trusting in Jehovah. Then Hezekiah did a wonderful thing. He took that letter and spread it before the Lord, and he prayed. Then the angel of the Lord went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. 185,000 men died. One angel. Now do you begin to see how much power is represented in 12 legions of angels, 60,000 angels? Now do you wonder that the schemes and plans of the enemies of Jesus failed? And this also accounts for Jesus' calm assurance throughout his ministry on earth. Don't you think he knew they were scheming against him? He knew every thought they had and every move they made. He could read them like a book. He had the power to read their minds. Matthew 22:18 says, Jesus perceived their wickedness. We read in Mark 2:8, and immediately when Jesus perceived in his spirit that they so reasoned within themselves, he said unto them, Why reason ye these things in your hearts? Luke 5:22 records that Jesus perceived their thoughts. And Luke 20:23 says, But Jesus perceived their craftiness. So he wasn't being fooled a bit. But do you realize what this means? It means that almost every moment of his ministry, he was conscious of plots against his life. He always knew who was plotting and why and where. I think the words of the hymn, I know not what awaits me, God kindly veils mine eyes. And, oh, blissful lack of knowledge, 'tis better not to know. That applies to us. We don't know, and it's better for us not to know certain things, so we won't have to worry about them. But Jesus knew. He knew they would eventually kill him, and he knew how they would kill him. He knew that he would be crucified. He said in John 12:32-33, And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me. This he said, signifying what death he should die. And in Matthew 20:19-26:2, he told his disciples plainly that he would be crucified. And now let us see in what way these things apply to us. Jesus' hour finally came. He was about to leave his beloved disciples. With his heart overflowing with love for them, he prayed a beautiful and inspiring prayer recorded in the 17th chapter of John. He said, in effect, Dear Father, my hour is now come. I have glorified your name on earth, and I finished the work you gave me to do. I am about to leave the world and come back to you. But these you have given me, these apostles and disciples, and those that shall in the future believe on me through their word, they will stay in the world after I have gone. The world will hate them just as it has hated me. Although those of the world hated me, they could not touch me, because until now my hour had not yet come. I always had your complete protection, dear Father, knowing that if I asked, you would send 60,000 angels to my assistance. I won't need this protection anymore, but they will, because they are staying in the world. Holy Father, keep them through thine own name. I pray not that thou shouldst take them out of the world, but that thou shouldst keep them from evil, just as you kept me from evil. Do you see the wonderful thing that is implied here? It would almost seem as if this prayer of Jesus, made just before his death, was a sort of last will and testament. He asked the Heavenly Father to give us the very same watch care and protection he himself had enjoyed when on earth, to pass it on to us. And this would surely include God's constant leading and direction in every affair of life, and over it all his loving, protecting care, delivering us from evil. And what is the measure of this protection, the extent of it? Even to the providing of 12 legions or 60,000 angels, should it ever become necessary. And just as his enemies could not touch Jesus or take his life before his hour had come, we have that self-same protection. So we find that during his ministry, Jesus continually suffered the wrath of men and the contradiction of sinners against himself. The scribes and Pharisees and elders and doctors of the law and others hated him, opposed him, attacked him, and tried to discredit him. Our text says, "Surely the wrath of men shall praise thee." How was God praised by these attacks? And we are also told to consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself. What can be gained from such a consideration? The answer is that it was their attacks upon Jesus that brought forth some of the most precious truths of our Lord's ministry. It was in this way that the wrath of men resulted in the praise of God. Let us now consider two of these attacks and the lessons they taught. The enemies of Jesus spied on him day and night in their efforts to find occasion against him. And one thing they accused him of over and over again was his supposed desecration of the Sabbath. Now, why do you suppose they harped on this so much? Was it because they loved God and God's law so very much that they felt impelled as God's champions to defend every letter of the law? Or was it because they loved the people so much that they felt that this supposed bad example of Jesus and his disciples should not be permitted to deceive them? If these were their motives, we could respect them for it. Mistaken as they might be, these at least would be honest motives. But let us remember that these men had murder in their hearts. These were not honorable men. So what was their overwhelming interest in Sabbath keeping? What was their object in ever accusing Jesus of breaking the Sabbath? The secret is this. The ancient penalty for Sabbath breaking was death by stoning. This is brought out in Numbers 15:32-36. Now do you get the point? All that these wonderful champions of the law wanted was to catch Jesus doing something punishable by death. Then they would be rid of him, legally, a nice clean way, without soiling their hands, so to speak. Of course, if all other methods failed, they could still take him with hired killers, but this would be done only as a last resort. First, they would try finesse. Now let us consider an incident recorded by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We will reconstruct the scene from the brief accounts given. One Sabbath morning, as the Pharisees were spying as usual, Jesus and his disciples walked along a path leading through a wheat field. They were on their way to the synagogue where Jesus would teach that day. Jesus was deeply engrossed in his thoughts, and if he was hungry, he was not conscious of it. But his disciples were hungry. So they picked ears of fresh wheat as they walked, and rubbing them between their palms to remove the chaff, they ate the grains. It was probably quite delicious. Have you ever had whole wheat for breakfast? The Pharisees immediately pounced upon them. "What you are doing is unlawful," they cried, with righteous indignation. Jesus stopped and looked at them. "Why?" he asked. "Your disciples are working on the Sabbath," they said. "How so?" "When they pick the wheat, they are reaping, and when they rub off the chaff, they are threshing, and when they blow the chaff away, they are winnowing. These are acts of labor and are forbidden on the Sabbath day." Jesus knew their evil motives, but he answered them patiently. We read from Matthew 12:3-8. "But he said unto them, Have ye not read what David did when he was anhungered, and they that were with him, how he entered into the house of God and did eat the show bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests? Or have ye not read in the law how that on the Sabbath day the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath, that is, by working, and are blameless? But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple. But if ye had known what this meaneth, I will have mercy and not sacrifice, ye would not have condemned the guiltless. For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day." This seemed to silence the Pharisees, not because they agreed with Jesus, but because they knew that their position was weak. And undoubtedly by this time a crowd sympathetic to Jesus had gathered. The scribes and Pharisees had a healthy respect for Jesus' keen mind and no desire to match wits with him before the people. They always came off second best in such encounters. Anyway, they could not use this incident against Jesus personally. He had not plucked and eaten any wheat, and it was Jesus they wanted to entrap and kill. So they retreated for now. But there was another reason for their withdrawing. They knew that he was on his way to the synagogue, and they had set a trap for him there. This time they would involve Jesus personally. Then they would stone him. And what was the trap? They had hunted up a man with a withered hand and stationed him at the entrance to the synagogue. If Jesus healed him on the Sabbath, they would accuse him. They considered such healings a breach of the law, which forbade any activity on the Sabbath. There would be plenty of witnesses, too, because a crowd would be waiting, as usual, to accompany Jesus into the synagogue to hear him teach. This incident is also recorded by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I will read portions of it from the different accounts. This part is from the 3rd chapter of Mark. "And they watched him, whether he would heal on the Sabbath day, that they might accuse him." If they had hoped to take Jesus by surprise, they were mistaken. He knew exactly what was going on. The poor man with the withered hand was huddled in a corner. The scribes and Pharisees had probably told him that if he stayed there, he would be healed, and he trembled in hopeful anticipation. Jesus was angry, not only because the scribes and Pharisees sought to entrap him, but also because they had hypocritically used this poor, innocent man to bait their trap. They had enticed him with the promise that he would be healed, yet they fully intended to condemn the Master for healing him. They had hearts of flint. Jesus knew all this because he knew their thoughts. Now we read from Luke's account in the 6th chapter. But he knew their thoughts, and said to the man which had the withered hand, Rise up and stand forth in the midst. And he arose and stood forth. Then said Jesus unto them, I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath days to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it? They dropped their eyes. They could not answer. If they replied that the law forbade a good deed, their answer would be repeated all over town, eagerly passed from mouth to mouth by the common people, casting discredit on these proud defenders of the law. So they held their peace. Then we read from Matthew's account. What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much, then, is a man better than a sheep? Wherefore it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath days. They would not answer, so he answered his own question. The crowd was spellbound with this drama that was being enacted before their eyes. Every eye was upon Jesus, the strong, perfect man, the great teacher and healer, literally radiating energy, and also on the pale, shrunken man standing before him with one good arm and the other a short, useless appendage hanging limply at his side. The scribes and Pharisees began to feel nervous. Things were not working out exactly as they had expected. They sensed that somehow they themselves were about to fall into the pit they had dug for Jesus. We continue with Mark's account. And when he had looked round about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he said unto the man, Stretch forth thine hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored whole as the other. Their plot against Jesus had completely collapsed. They had known, of course, that Jesus would heal the man with a withered hand, and as soon as he did so, they had intended to loudly accuse him of Sabbath breaking before all the people. Then they had expected to harangue and stir up the people against Jesus. They probably had hecklers planted in the crowd who would at the right moment cry out, Stone him! Stone him! They may even have had stones heaped handily nearby, so that before anyone knew what was happening, Jesus would be dead. It was a beautiful plan, but it just didn't work out that way. Something went wrong. Jesus had taken the initiative away from them completely. The crowd now looked on them with hostility and contempt. So they sullenly slipped away. Matthew says, Then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him, how they might destroy him. Mark says, And the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. And Luke says, And they were filled with madness and communed one with another what they might do to Jesus. Filled with madness. That certainly describes the wrath of men, does it not? Now let us go back and consider how these cases of the wrath of men resulted in teaching us precious truths to the praise of God. Take the incident when the disciples of Jesus plucked and ate the ears of wheat while walking through the wheat field on the Sabbath. To interpret this simple act to be reaping, threshing, and winnowing, and hence a violation of the Sabbath, is manifestly absurd. And it was such absurdities only that Jesus combated, not the true keeping of the commandment. Jesus himself kept the law in every respect. But over the years, the Jewish religionists had evolved a long and tedious list of prohibitions regarding the Sabbath, which were ridiculous and burdensome. For example, if a man scratched or hunted for a flea on the Sabbath, he was violating the Sabbath. Why? It was claimed that the man was hunting, as truly as though it were a buffalo or a lion. It was also argued that if anyone walked upon the grass with nailed shoes upon the Sabbath day, he would violate the law. Why? Because he would inevitably trample out some of the grass seeds, and that would be threshing. It was even debated whether or not a fresh egg should be eaten on the first day of the week, since it implied work on the part of the hen on the seventh day, the Sabbath. Such ridiculous trivialities irked Jesus. The law, as given in Exodus 20:8-10, says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son nor thy daughter, thy maidservant and manservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates." And then we read the words of Jesus in Mark 2:27. "And he said unto them, The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath." So it is clear that the Sabbath was given for the benefit of mankind, for man's physical, mental, and moral rest and recuperation and strengthening. A day of rest, whether on the seventh day or other day, is absolutely necessary for humankind. After the French Revolution, when a wave of irreligion swept over France, they enacted a law abolishing rest on Sunday. "We will accomplish much more without a day's cessation of labor," they said. After a while, there were wholesale physical and nervous breakdowns among the populace, and a day of rest had to be restored to the people. So, aside from its typical significance, the fourth commandment was an eminently wise law. It was supposed to be purely a day of rest, and it was originally, but now it had become instead a day of worry over trivialities. They had complicated it and perverted it. Instead of relaxing and refreshing them, the Sabbath now keyed them up and built up their anxieties. They asked themselves, "Am I, without knowing it, reaping or threshing or winnowing or hunting or eating an egg produced on the Sabbath?" The time came when it was such a chore to keep the Sabbath, with all its formalities and fears, that the people dreaded its coming and were glad when the sun set upon it so that they could relax in the normal pursuits of a working day. These were the conditions Jesus found and combated during his ministry. It was just such another case of Satan subtly and gradually perverting the laws of God, holding them up to ridicule. On the occasion we are considering, Jesus rebuked the scribes and Pharisees, saying, "But if ye had known what this meaneth, 'I will have mercy and not sacrifice,' ye would not have condemned the guiltless." Mercy was something that they conspicuously lacked, and Jesus brought this out forcibly on the next occasion. Pointing to the man with the withered hand, he said, "What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep, and if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out?" What an eloquent illustration of mercy. A man has only one sheep, his sole possession. No great wealth, not a vast herd, but just one sheep. If that one sheep falls into a pit on the Sabbath day and cannot get out, and looks up at its master and cries piteously, will not the man out of simple mercy lift it out, whether it be on the Sabbath or not? Or will he, for the sake of the Sabbath, sacrifice the sheep and let it die in the pit? Jesus gave the answer by quoting his Heavenly Father's words, "I will have mercy and not sacrifice." Then, indicating the man with the withered hand, he said, "How much then is a man better than a sheep?" And what a beautiful illustration this is, too, of humankind, like the poor sheep fallen into the pit of sin and death, utterly unable by their own efforts to raise themselves out, looking up and crying piteously to their master for help, seeking after God if haply they might find him, groaning and travailing in pain together. And how happy we are for the great mercy that will lay hold on that sheep during the Sabbath age, the millennium, and lift it out. Jesus also said, "For the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day." What does this mean? Immediately following the commandment relating to the Sabbath, we read in Exodus 20:11, "For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is, and rested on the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." We know, of course, that these 6 days of creation were not 24-hour days, but each one was thousands of years in length. Having established his human son in Eden as ruler of the earth at the end of the sixth day, Jehovah God rested from work on the seventh day, which is a period of 7,000 years. To whom, then, did he entrust the affairs of humankind? Who, then, became the Lord of this seventh day or Sabbath, extending 7,000 years from the creation of man to the restoration of man at the end of the millennial age? He appointed his Son, Jesus Christ, to be this Lord of the Sabbath, to carry out his will, to redeem and rescue humankind, to select his bride and church, to lay hold of the sheep and raise it out of the pit, to conquer and subdue all evil, and finally present it all faultless to his Heavenly Father. As Paul expressed it in 1 Corinthians 15:24-28, "Then the end, when he shall have delivered up to the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power, for he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. For he hath put all things under his feet, but when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted which did put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all." So when Jesus told the scribes and Pharisees that he was Lord of the Sabbath, he did not mean that he had the right to set aside the requirements of the Sabbath. Quite the contrary. He was telling them, although they could not understand it, that his work was in fulfillment of the larger meaning of the Sabbath, that the entire 7,000-year Sabbath operation was under his control and command. While the seventh day was beneficial to the Jew as a day of rest, it was given for another very important reason. It was also typical. It typified the Christian's rest of faith, a close heart relationship to the Lord, a complete and utter reliance on him, a complete love for him. And instead of demanding but one day of seven, as the Jewish law did, the law of love controls and regulates our entire time. 7 days in the week we are to love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. 7 days in the week we are to love our neighbors as ourselves. And 7 days in the week we are to rest also, rest from our own works, rest by faith in the finished work of Christ, rest in the love of God, rest in the peace of God which passeth all understanding, ruling in our hearts continually. As the Apostle explains the matter in Hebrews 4:1-11, "Let us therefore fear, lest a promise being left us of entering into his rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. For we which have believed do enter into rest. There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. For he that is entered into his rest, he also has ceased from his own works, as God did from his. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest. And while enjoying this Sabbath of rest in advance, how we long for the rest to come to the world, when all cruelty and viciousness and heartbreak and hopelessness and fear and despair will come to an end, when the nobility and dignity of man will be restored, and kindness and helpfulness and love and hope will fill the earth, and we will have a part in bringing this about.